we've all heard this morning and this afternoon that artistic creation is one of the great sort of organic processes sort of underway in civilization. It's really remarkable what people can do when they put their minds, their hearts, and emotions to creating something out of nothing. But in fact, as we've also learned, in many cases, they're not simply creating out of nothing. They're creating out of someone else's artistic creation. Put in its less benign terms, good artists borrow and great artists steal. But as one of the websites that I've seen recently describes it, perhaps in a slightly better way, all artists are standing on the shoulders of giants. And today we're exploring, this afternoon, the rights that artists have, both in a kind of legal and moral as well as communitarian sense, to control their works, and wondering how that might be balanced with the incentive to encourage creativity by downstream artists, those who would borrow ideas, but perhaps even expression. And so speaking of giants, let me introduce the panel. First will be John Perry Barlow, who I'm sure is known by reputation to each and every person sitting in this room. He is truly a giant in thinking as well as musicianship, and of course it must be said that he's been involved at the Berkman Center for a very, very long time, and importantly is co-founder and the current vice chair of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Going next is Rebecca Tushnet, who is now an assistant professor, I believe, at Georgetown. Is that right, Rebecca? She's had a number of distinguished clerkships. Not the least, but perhaps not the greatest, of her accomplishments is that she was an associate two doors down from me at Debevoise & Plimpton in Washington. But she's written a couple of very important articles, including one in the Yale Law Journal, How Fair Use Doctrine Harms Free Speech and How Copying Serves It, which takes direct issue with the assertion in the Eldred case that there is very little expressive value in speaking someone else's speech, as well as an article on fan fiction. Going third will be Jenny Toomey, who is the executive director of the Future of Music Coalition. She describes herself as an intellectual and activist and a musician, and those of us who have seen her and come to know her would agree with much of that. She speaks widely and is very well respected in this space. Next, we have Shoshana Zisk, who's an entertainment lawyer with experience in the music industry, and we look forward to hearing about her experience with musicians. And finally, Siva Vaidyanathan, who is a cultural historian, a media scholar, has also written one of the most influential tracts in this area, Copyrights and Copy Wrongs, The Rise of Intellectual Property and How It Threatens Creativity, also speaks and writes widely beyond that book and has been a great inspiration to a number of people. So without any further ado, what I'd like to do is pose a couple of questions for the panel and see what they might have to say on the topic du jour. And I think the questions revolve around the question of how artists feel when their works are reused by others, either for creative exploitation or for other, perhaps, less creative purposes. And if so, what do they do about it? Do they resort to legal remedies? Do they do something less than that? For example, rely on sort of goodwill? Do they see a lawyer, or do they simply ask for a credit or attribution? Conversely, if someone is a reuser, and these, of course, can be the same people, how do they feel about reusing the work of others? Do they go out and seek permission? Are they absolutely scrupulous about giving credit or attribution? Or do they do neither? Is, in fact, part of the artistic process neither crediting nor seeking permission? And then finally, when artists are agitated about the reuse of their rights, what legal remedies might be available to them? And so with that is a very broad set of sort of softball questions. Why don't we start it off with you?
I was looking for the question mark anywhere in there. Actually, I'll just tell you a little story, which I hope will appeal as much to your sense of irony as it does mine. As many of you may know, I've been pretty vocal for a long time about the problems of copyright in the digital era and the impropriety of trying to own mind on such a massive scale, and how I felt that the artist would be best taken care of by another set of economic understandings, which assumed that there was a relationship between familiarity and value, and was not so interested in regulating towards scarcity. But recently I got a phone call from the current president of Grateful Dead Productions, who has been associated with the band for many, many years, is a really good guy, is a very thoughtful person. And he said, I just want to bounce something around with you. I mean, I know that you told your friend Brewster Kahle to go ahead and put all of our concerts on archive.org and not to worry about getting permission because it was better to apologize than ask permission. And I said, yeah, I did that. And he said, well, you know, and you know that I don't have a problem with that or haven't had a problem with that, but all of a sudden we find ourselves in this position where we're no longer performing and where our principal product is downloads over iTunes and other commercial sites. And every single one of our concerts is on archive.org. And so we are suddenly competing against free in exactly the same form as we are charging for. Now, previously we've been competing against free when we could put out CDs. We're putting out CDs. We were putting out concerts. We were putting out a lot of things. But now that we're doing downloads, and you can do downloads of the same material for free, the deadheads are going out on their lists and saying, don't bother paying these old bastards. Get everything from archive.org. He said, what do you think we ought to do about this? I said, I'll get back to you. I don't know. You know, finally we have arrived, and fortunately I'm here to tell you that my own personal interests are at stake in a very direct way that I haven't experienced before. And I'm struggling for the right kind of creative solution to this. Because all of the previous things that I could say about this are no longer really valid. So I'm just going to tell you that story and we'll move on.
Okay.
Okay, well, I have a much less interesting story, but I mean, I come to this as someone who identifies as an academic and as a media fan, starting with Star Trek on. My job depends on my writing, but not in the sense that it depends on how well I sell my writing. It depends on getting published by organizations that are not themselves conventionally profit-seeking, so, and hoping that my colleagues think that that's good enough to get me tenure. So my incentives as a creator are very different, I think, than certainly anyone who gets money from iTunes. So when I was thinking about the topic of this, first of all, I noticed that this is for Harvard Law, this is a very lawyer-light conference. You may not be able to tell from this panel, but really the percentages are quite low. There are so many artists here, and I was thinking whether what extent we could say artists are like lawyers. And I think both of us interpret in order to do things. That is, we often think of interpretation as something that's done sort of maybe navel-gazing, maybe in the derogatory sense of academic. It produces esoteric knowledge. But interpretation does more than that. Interpretation of the law produces legal results. It tells you who has to pay money, who has to do things. Interpretation of things out there in the world or thing or artistic works that have come before also do things. You know, they tell us about ourselves. They entertain us. You know, they produce results. And then with this in mind, I thought about a question that I've been thinking about actually since college, before even law school. It comes out of critical legal studies, which is a movement in law that focuses on the importance of interpreters and as constituting the meaning of a text, so in or the audience as constituting the meaning of a text. Oh, thank you. And I read a long time ago a critique of critical legal studies, which asked the following question. First of all, you know, if you're an academic who believes in critical legal studies, the audience is primary. Have you ever been misread? You know, if you think you've been misread, how can you think that the audience should have authority to interpret that's as good as yours, the author? More than that, this author proposed a thought experiment. Suppose, he said, I were to read the Constitution as the story of a small boy growing up in Kansas. Suppose, in fact, I were to read all texts that way. Would that just be an interpretation, or would that be wrong? Right. So shouldn't, in other words, shouldn't the text, shouldn't the author have more authority? I mean, the words are quite are related than the audience. Now, you know, the legal authors we're concerned with are usually dead, so we can't really ask them. In the cases that we've been talking about, the authors are sometimes still around. They're alive, they're kicking, they or their heirs are occasionally suing. And so what deference do we owe them? And I think of two things as important. One is attribution or credit. And in general, I think the answer is yes, although the point about the Republican National Convention and Johnny Cash I thought was quite interesting because there it's clear that the music is Johnny Cash's. The problem is that Johnny Cash may not endorse the conclusions being drawn from putting his name next to the Republicans, and I think that's an important problem. The second thing is deference to the author's interpretation. So in the community that I'm most interested in, the media fandom community, if J.K. Rowling doesn't want people writing sexy stories about Harry Potter characters, you know, do we owe her a duty not to do that? And while I'm basically in favor of attribution, I'm less in favor of that, in part because I think it's a futile endeavor. If someone reads Harry Potter and hates the book and writes a bad review of it, that could harm J.K. Rowling's interest. It could harm her self-esteem. It could harm her ability to write. I mean, good reviews can also harm authors' ability to write. But we don't generally think that authors should be immune from that sort of thing because that's part of putting your work out there in the world. And similarly, when someone says, well, you know, the ending of that book was terrible, it would have been much better if, and proceeds to tell a story, I think that's pretty much on the same continuum. The last thing I want to say, because I know we're short on time, is going back to attribution and credit. There's this sense that attribution is a simple thing. And I don't think it really is. There was the Johnny Cash example mentioned, that attribution may go much further. It may turn into endorsement, and the author may see a problem with that. The flip side is attribution doesn't always have to be explicit. You know, if I start quoting to be or not to be at you, I don't expect you to think that I wrote those words. In fact, I expect you to recognize, and I would be shocked to be called a plagiarist just because I didn't attribute. Similarly, no more would we think of a jazz musician as a plagiarist who doesn't stop and tell you where all his influences come from. We recognize in certain contexts that that's part of the process. So when we talk about attribution, when works are remixed, in things like, you know, the Grey album, I think we have to consider whether attribution is sort of inherent in the practice with the groups that you're addressing, right? Or with the machinima, it's sort of inherently obvious that the game developers are responsible for some part of it, and the people who wrote the script for the particular machinima are responsible for another part. So I will stop there.
Okay, thanks.
I wanted to respond to the question. I represent George Clinton. George Clinton is one of the, I would say, I think he's like the second most sampled musicians. I think he's like right behind James Brown. I think part of the reason is just because when sampling first emerged, hip-hop artists had grown up listening, their parents grew up listening to Parliament, listening to Funkadelic, and when the sampling technology came around, I guess a few people decided to do it, and George Clinton came out and he was like very public in support of it, and he loved it. In fact, most artists, if you ask the artists themselves, they love it. They love having it happen. I know you as an artist, you please, everybody, for free, take it, listen to it, experience me, listen to me. He even went so far, he created this three-volume set called Sample Sum of Disc, Sample Sum of Dat. He actually went into his archives, and he pulled out all of his master tapes. He took them out one by one, and he just made it very easy for people to do. And I even had forgotten about this. My husband, Brian, pointed out to me that he actually had a license inside. This is 1994, very close to the Creative Commons license, before it had even been invented. Pretty much said, you know, if you want to sample anything on any of my recordings commercially, just send me a fax or in writing which recording you've sampled. Provide the name of the song. If you have a record company, tell me the name of the record company. Otherwise, just give me your name and address. And then we're going to issue you a sample use license contract to you and your record company. We're not going to charge you or your record company any upfront flat fee for the use of the samples. And you or your record company will just pay on each record sold a fee equal to the then current single song statutory mechanical copyright license in your territory. Easy. So we kind of came up with this. What kind of went wrong is that he had a falling out with the person who had actually been his business partner, and they ended up going to litigation with each other, and then it turned out that this business partner had somehow gotten all the rights, and now George doesn't own anything, and so he's actually never been compensated for any of this music. And then that guy turned around, now he's second in the chain of title. The person who's second in the chain of title of the copyright, those are always the first ones to send the nasty grams. They're always the first ones to say, hey, you can't do this without, you know, the authors themselves, they love it. The other people who are going to benefit from it, they're, you know, all over you. So anyway, so they turned around and sued, I think, 800 record companies in Nashville, Tennessee. Those cases are ongoing. And it's really sad because a lot of people are like, why is George suing me? I'm like, George is not suing you. In fact, George himself is being sued for ostensibly sampling his own music by this guy. And he's one of the defendants with you in this lawsuit. We're trying to figure out how we're going to deal with it. So I think that would answer your question.
It doesn't in a way. The question is whether or not many, if not all, musicians feel just like George. And maybe Jenny can provide us with some views on that.
Yes, I can. But I have to start with attribution, which is Future of Music owes a great debt to this conference and this university. I just ate two cookies, and I'm having this crazy, like, sugar thing right now, But I just want to say that I met two of my board members at the last Signal or Noise conference, and we formed the organization after the conference. So Future of Music really owes a lot to Harvard, and thanks. Thanks. It's very important to have people talk about this stuff in ways that are different than the ways that they're talked about in the commercial marketplace. And John was making fun of my, or teasing in a nice way, my bio for saying that I'm an intellectual. But I think, you know, really, what it doesn't say in my bio is I'm a rocker. And that's what I come to this stuff from. I'm a musician, and I'm a musician that came from, I mean, most musicians come from this place, but I came from punk rock, which is even more so a counterculture, culture that doesn't see itself as part of the mainstream culture, culture that has a lot of rules, but they maybe are not the exact same rules that are copyright law or are commercial major label business. It doesn't make them any less important to the community we live in. But they do often run afoul of of what the existing commercial laws are. That said, because I'm an intellectual and because I'm a rocker, I understand that many times people step up to represent what artists think about things, and I don't agree with them. And it's not because some artists don't think that. It's because artists are as various as humans are. And anyone who says they know what artists think about something are lying to you for the most part. That said, as a curious person, which is what I think is almost the same word as intellectual, I was curious what artists really did think about this. And Kristen Thompson, who works at Future of Music, and I worked with the Pew Internet and the American Life Project to do a little survey of musicians, because people for years had been talking about what artists wanted. You know, I remember, you know, some are very wrong and right. I remember some academic on a panel talked about how artists wanted to make their money by selling T-shirts at the last Signaler Noise conference, and I knew, well, that might be one or two artists, but it certainly wasn't the norm. So I don't want to read all these statistics, and in order to ensure that I wouldn't, I only have 16 minutes before my computer will run out of juice. But what I will say is there are certain things. First of all, musicians are very divided about the impact of file sharing. And what we found that was really, I mean, it wasn't a surprise to anybody who talks to musicians, but we found pretty much a third of musicians really love the emerging technologies. A third of musicians really hate the emerging technologies. And about a third really don't know what they think about the emerging technologies. So whether you're on the good side or the bad side, you could say, you know, more than half don't like them, or more than half do like them, or whatever. Drag the middle to whatever side, and that's what we always see happen on TV and in the press when they talk about this stuff. What's so interesting about this as well is, you know, you find exactly what you predict. Artists that make a lot of money from the existing model are the ones that hate the emerging markets. Artists that are locked out of the emerging model, as Walter talked about with media consolidation and major label consolidation and all of this, they really love this because, you know, you can't be an artist if you don't have an audience. So this is a way to get an audience. Two other things that came out of the survey that I think are very important to focus on is 67% of the artists said that they should have complete control over material they copyright, and they also say that copyright laws do a good job protecting them, meaning that we don't need to change them. But the 67% is pretty good because artists will hold on to this, right? You know, they'll say we want other people to hear it until somebody does something we don't like with it, and then we don't want anybody to have a right to do something else with it. But what I think the question needs to be moved away from the sort of theory of control towards compensation a lot more, because the metaphor we always use, or I always use, about people or artists holding tightly onto their copyrights, and these are the kind of people who say, I really want to play the song for you, but I'm afraid that if you hear it, you might copy it, and I haven't copywritten it yet. You know, it's as if that one song needs to be isolated in order to be safe. This reminds me a lot of sort of what happens in a bad neighborhood, where people lock all the doors and the windows and put on the security service because they're afraid that they're going to get robbed or beat up or something bad's going to happen to them. But the truth of the matter is the best way to turn a neighborhood around is actually to create sort of the neighborhood patrol communities where everybody actually puts on the orange hats, opens all the doors and windows, meets their neighbors and walks around and circulates. And so I think that there is a real case, and maybe this is an overbroad metaphor, but for the idea that circulation actually can clear up this, both circulation of information and circulation of access. The question is, how do we actually build or architect a system that values creativity enough to actually compensate it? Now, I'm not saying we need to be protectionist about the existing system, but that I need that factor, the idea that this artistic labor is valuable, needs to be embedded into whatever structure we build. I know a lot of people are very happy to say, you know, in the future, technology will take care of that. Maybe it will. I mean, John told a story that I never thought I would ever hear him say a few minutes ago about maybe the way it's not taking care of it for the band that's always been the poster children for how it takes care of it. But what I would say specifically is we know from Larry Lessig, who I don't know if he was at the last one. He's from here, right? We know from Larry Lessig that the internet won't even be open unless we actually see openness as a value and figure out a way to architect that into the structures. So the thing that I want to say finally is that in the same study, there was, I think, 33 million Americans who considered themselves artists. This goes back to Yochai's point, right, which is that all this technology allows us to be artistic in a way. It's folk culture coming back through the sort of the digits. And at least 10 million Americans earn money from their performances. So when we architect these structures, we also need to take into account the fact that traditionally these structures are built by the artists that are most successful, and that might be locking artists away from actually engaging in this process. 33 million Americans think of themselves as artists, so let's make sure the structures serve them too.
Thanks. Right. Stephen? Do you all miss the year 2000 as much as I do? Back in the year 2000, I had hair in the year 2000, but that's besides the point. We were asking, as a culture and a country, some pretty naive, simple questions at the time that seem charming now. How valuable will my Enron stock be? what are we going to do with this budget surplus? And is oral sex really sex? Soon after, we all found that those questions were a big waste of time. But in the spring of 2000, I came here and met for the first time a whole lot of really sharp thinkers who had been delving into questions of the interface between technology and culture for some time. I hadn't really published in the area. I wasn't a well-known name, just a long one. And I was blessed by being able to meet a whole lot of interesting, open-minded people who brought me into this community. And it certainly was led by people like Charlie Nesson and Terry Fisher, who helped put on the first version of this conference, Signal or Noise 1.0. And it was an exciting time. Jenny talked about the people she met and the difference that this conference made in her intellectual growth, her social growth, and hopefully the prospect of a better life for musicians all over this country, which I'm pretty bullish about. Her coalition has already done some impressive work and is destined to make a real difference. But we also asked some really interesting questions 5 years ago. We asked really interesting questions about methods of distribution and the effects, macro and microeconomic effects, of new methods of distribution for the ephemeral, like products that don't have to be shipped in boxes. We asked similar questions about the stakes of creativity, the ethical and moral stakes of creativity, the substance of creativity, the process of creativity. What makes a person creative? What does a creative person owe the rest of us, and what do we owe creative people? And we started some really fascinating conversations. From that set of questions, we came up with a couple of pretty naive conclusions. I remember not a year later, some very smart people who were at that conference, some very smart people who were at this conference, were saying things like, within a year or two, we're going to see the complete demise and destruction of the commercial music industry as we know it. Didn't happen. Not going to happen. But we also saw some really prescient observations come out of that. A widespread understanding that culture and the culture industries are not zero sum. That one action does not generate an equal and opposite reaction. In other words, every download is not a lost sale. Every dollar not spent is not a lost dollar to someone else. That's not really how culture works. We all sort of knew it intuitively. Now we have plenty of evidence for that. We also saw a flowering of really interesting scholarship. I mean, some astounding law review articles that really pushed these issues in original and fresh ways. Not too long before this conference in 2000, intellectual property was boring. I'm not kidding. It really was. No, I know. I know you're saying, what? No, it really was boring. But no longer. Right after 2000, there was no way anybody was going to consider it boring. Now, in 2000, there were a lot of storms brewing. And I don't just mean the election. Peer-to-peer was not really on our agenda 5 years ago, as it is now. In other words, peer-to-peer hadn't quite occurred to us in these terms. In 2000, the what was on everybody's lips was emusic.com. That was going to be the great changing factor in the music industry. We had no way to even ask the big questions about the cultural and economic effects of peer-to-peer, and we now have very slim data. We have a lot of speculation, a lot of tirades, a lot of guesses, a lot of pontification, and I'm guilty of much of it. But we still don't know the long-term effects. So as I said, we asked a lot of good questions back then. We produced a lot of interesting work. Since that conference, two books by Larry Lessig, two books by Kembrew McLeod, one book by Jessica Littman, one book by Terry Fisher that everybody here should make sure to read, two books by me. So we were actually able to create a big pile of paper that took on these sorts of questions. We've seen a legal record emerge that reflects a lot of those concerns, the Napster case, the 2600 case, Newton versus Diamond, Bridgeport, Grokster, and it's, of course, it's not ending. But I want to pose six questions that I hope will guide our explorations for the next 5 years. I hope we all get together in 5 years to look back at this. First, a question inspired by Robert Rodriguez, a guy I went to college with. We were actually buddies in college, although can't get him to return my email now. He's the director of Sin City most recently, but he also did the Spy Kids movies and Once Upon a Time in Mexico. And he's done probably 10 really interesting films, not all of them of the same sort of style and genre. Bobby Rodriguez, when he was in college, had an amazing VHS and Beta collection. Like everybody who was on their way to being a creative person or a creative filmmaker in the mid-80s, thanks to the Betamax case, we all had a really strong, interesting library of the history of film in our homes, in our dorms, in our apartments, in Austin, Texas, the sort of place that didn't used to produce filmmakers. Not a lot of filmmakers came from Austin, Texas before Robert Rodriguez, Richard Linklater. I mean, we were all part of the same milieu. And we all had these not that I ever became a filmmaker, but, I hung out with these guys. It was kind of fun. We had these amazing libraries. Libraries enabled by the Betamax case. Had Betamax gone the other way, had one justice chosen the other way, Robert Rodriguez might never have become what he became. He was a cartoonist when I knew him. That might have been his career. And I compare his experience to Scorsese. Scorsese had the privilege of growing up in a place with a lot of sort of a live film archive all around him. He had lots of film houses that would play movies from the 30s and 40s. All of the great noir classics Scorsese could immerse himself in, the gangster films of the 30s that would inform his own language of film. Well, people who didn't grow up in New York or San Francisco or Chicago didn't have those sorts of art houses and repertory houses. People who didn't grow up in Paris didn't get a full view of the world's cinema until after the VCR revolution, right? The magnetic tape revolution of the 70s and 80s that gave us access to these amazing libraries. So my research question from that is, what will be the cultural effects of these astounding digital libraries that have sprung up all around us? Digital libraries like Kazaa that offer so many people access to sound, video, and text. Are we going to see another set of Robert Rodriguez's come out of places like San Antonio or Lagos, Nigeria, because they were able to hear something really cool that moved them? My second question, so where is the pain and where is the gain? We thought naively that the pain would be centered in the major labels of the American music industry. It's not so clear. I'll tell you, we have a pretty good view that the pain of these changes is centered in the small business person, the person who owned the record store two blocks from my house, the person who dared to open a record store in Mexico in the 90s. There are almost no CD stores in Mexico left anymore, largely because of CD burning, not because of peer-to-peer. So where is the pain and where is the gain in this? We know that Radiohead and Wilco have great stories of gaining from digital distribution. But what about the Mexican CD vendor? What about the truck driver? How can we quantify the pain there? Third question, will all of these stories of copyright absurdity, and we're all familiar with them, will they combine with the stories of American arrogance in a variety of ways to spark a global free culture movement? We have a pretty strong American free culture movement. It's also strong in Western Europe. It's gestational in places, really interesting places like Brazil and India, but are we going to see it in Hong Kong? Are we going to see it in Lagos, Nigeria? Lagos, Nigeria, by the way, is one of those fascinating places because it has no traditional commercial media infrastructure like we're used to, right? No Blockbusters, no Time Warner Cable, no Star TV even. Yet people are immersed in media worlds entirely driven by pirate entrepreneurs, pirate ventures. Something to keep in mind. My fourth question, and I think this is probably the easiest one to answer, and the one we should delve into, and the one that Rebecca has already taken on, is fair use fair or useful? Is it one of those tools that can actually matter to us in the next 10 years? Or is it quaint? Is it too rickety a structure for us to balance so many important values and decisions on? I have a hunch about that, but I won't get into it. The fifth question, what is not getting made? And this is almost an impossible research question to pursue. But what is not getting made? What is not getting made because of underinvestment in certain industries? You know, are people fearful about investing in the next $40 million film project for fear of global piracy? Maybe. I'd like to see that documented if it really is a problem. But what is also not getting made because of the chilling effects of litigation? Again, we've started on this anecdotally. I'd like to see a more sophisticated way of answering this question, what is not getting made. And my sixth and final question, inspired by Walter McDonough, one of the brilliant people I met 5 years ago here, is there a relationship, is there a possible relationship between the media reform movements in this country and the free culture movements? Is there common cause? Is there a way of harnessing all of the energy we've seen come out of free software, out of all this cool stuff being made up here, and the political economy critique of major media corporations in this country? We all sort of know there's a lot in common, but can we actually harness these two movements? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Before I ask a question or open up to the floor, is there anyone who would like to respond to any of Siva's questions? No?
I would say one thing that's not being made because of consolidating forces is research and a lot of articles about the damage of media consolidation. That there's so much low-hanging fruit out there because the media doesn't cover things it doesn't want to cover. Just to give one example, at the telecommunications, the big fight that they had at the FCC a couple of years ago when Chairman Powell had a very pro deregulation, I don't like to say that, he wanted to allow more consolidation. And he kept saying, look, we don't need any more hearings. We don't need to hear what the public has to say about this because we've already received millions of comments. We don't need to have these hearings. And the reason he had to say that was because there were two FCC commissioners who was going around the country actually having hearings to find out what the public said, because a lot of stuff at the FCC is like what intellectual property was back before it was cool. People don't pay much attention to what's happening at these, you know, very high level, these sort of legislative discussions. So when they went around the world or around the country and talked to people, they found out that everybody was very unhappy about their media and they didn't want it to consolidate any further. So anyway, Powell kept saying, you know, we don't need more information. We have a lot of comments. But he never said that all the comments were against him. That's the one thing he didn't say. So there's a lot of low-hanging fruit. All we had to do was get 17 volunteers to count all the comments and read them. And we made a really nice pie chart that had a little sliver of people, about 18 that weren't business comments, you know, people in the industry that said, don't do this. But anyway, so I guess the point that I'm making is that there's a lot of work that needs to be done documenting it, not just even in these very theoretical ways, but very just what's in front of our face. Because I think a lot of the times we see these things, we think radio's gotten worse, and then you just need someone to tell you that one company went from owning 40 stations to 1,240, and then you can understand that there's a structural problem.
Thanks. Just one quick question. I mean, this panel has been focused in part on peer-to-peer, and I know that's been one of the sort of issues du jour at the Berkman Center and elsewhere. But is there something more to sort of the notion of copyright and technological challenge than simple reuse without paying money for a work? Put another way, Siva talked about fair use, And Rebecca talked about sort of transformative uses such as fan fiction. And should the law, as it does today, distinguish between commercial reuse, peer-to-peer file sharing, which is not commercial in the main, at least with respect to the end user, and the uses made by artists of the sort that perhaps George Clinton is encouraging. And I have in mind here a rather sharp distinction between music and other forms of work, where we heard Lawrence Ferrara this morning essentially assert that, of course, it was perfectly appropriate to require a license even if you only take three notes from music. That isn't clearly the view with respect to many, many other kinds of intellectual property, where we do have that rickety doctrine known as fair use. Yet the Sixth Circuit said, essentially, get a license every time sound sampling sort of rears its head. So I want to know whether the panel itself sees a difference among the different kinds of uses of intellectual property and has different reactions to those uses. John?
Well, you know, I think, speaking from a creative standpoint, I think most of us do have some resonance with the poll result of 66% of artists think they want to have control
67.
Over their... Well, I mean, it's about control to a certain extent. But, you know, interestingly enough, I think what most artists mean when they say control is something that is not protected under American copyright law at all, but, it's a sort of a vague notion of moral rights. And a very vague notion at that. None of us is very keen on the idea of having somebody we don't like politically or morally making use of our work, even if it's not for material gain. Most of us would have a real objection to somebody taking, I would have an objection to somebody taking one of my songs and tossing out half the words and replacing them with words I didn't like, which has happened, actually. I think that there is a whole issue of control here that is kind of separate and is easily separated out from the other issues with copyright as far as the artist is concerned.
Can I say something? I mean, when I heard that 67%, my reaction was, well, yeah, gee, I want a pony, right? I mean, yeah, of course. And if you ask them, would you like it to only have positive reviews of your work? Sure. Also, I'd like that too. So what we want to ask more is, is this a good idea? Is this a good deal to strike with artists? Or on the from the other end, aside from what you want, is there a moral entitlement to certain basic things like attribution or control if your work is used in a political context or control if your work is used to make money, right? Those identifying specific situations where control is a good idea, I think, may be more feasible, even if you think that you actually want to move away from control towards compensation, you still have to ask that same kind of question. And you also ask, and may want to ask, well, when is attribution a good idea?
I think that compensation will go a long way to getting people to voluntarily allow their stuff to circulate. And I think we just see that in the statutory license. You know, you put a record out, and any radio station in the country, whether you like them or not, can play that record once you release it, as long as they pay their fees to the performance rights organizations. So I think the question is how we build off that model to figure out other kinds of licensing structures that allow artists to actually see financial benefits for letting loose their work. You know, everybody's been talking about them having these benefits, but...
Do you think ASCAP works?
Well, I think it works. I think it works better once...
For anybody but the people running it?
No. I will see your critique of ASCAP and accept it. But what I really like about the Internet, and this is something we've been talking about a lot over the last 4 years, but the idea of an authentication database where basically, as we move towards this idea of all music being cataloged in some place so that you can actually license it, you actually could have transparent licensing, and then you would actually be able to see more clearly what was actually circulating, and then it would be very difficult for all of the money to flow to just 20% of the artists that license it through ASCAP and BMI. It's not a perfect system, but my feeling is that people, artists will not let go of their control until they actually see a benefit for it. You know, think of all the artists who say they would never sign a major label deal and sign it, even though everyone has already told them what a terrible contract it is. They've watched their friends fail at it and tear their hair out and all this other stuff. And it's a carrot and a stick thing. You know, we can tell artists you can't have any control, or we can lead them down the path towards allowing more usage by actually saying that we value your artistic labor enough to actually put a structure in place that will pay for some of it.
Well, the real strength of what Jenny's describing is that it's an experiment. I mean, its real strength is we don't know what would come out of that. We don't know if we can build a better ASCAP, but we're not going to know unless we try. The virtue of much of what Jenny is proposing is that status quo isn't really helping a lot of people. Maybe it is helping a lot of people, but it's not helping all the people in the way we would prefer to help them. The virtue of Terry Fisher's proposal is that it's an experiment. We've been locked in a rhetorical battle for at least 5 years, actually about 7 or 8 years, over these issues. And that has denied us the courage and the subtlety and the malleability that is an essential part of the willingness to experiment. A lot of what we need to do then is sort of dial down the passion about this stuff, dial down the rhetoric that is apocalyptic, dial down the rhetoric that is naively optimistic about the virtues of connectivity and digital technology, and understand that there are some basic problems that can be fixed, and we're not even going to get close to them unless we're willing to experiment.
Great. Let's turn it open to the audience. Yeah, I saw your question down here. Do you have a mic? Can you use the microphone? Thanks.
It's on. Attribution and derivation are linked in many cases, but they can be linked negatively as opposed to positively. In the field of film music, for example, film composers are almost always sign a contract that gives the producer the rights to strip out the music, change the music, couple the music with other music, etc. And the same producers insist that the composer give the producer the right to their likeness, name, etc. for the film. Many film composers, in fact, insist that if they give the producer the right, which they have to modify their music, that they have the right to remove their name and likeness from the film. So I think this is just an overall problem, no matter how you do it. There are linkages between derivation and attribution, and there are some models, and I think it does have to be addressed in some way.
Thank you. Clarification on the Higgins decision. My commentary was descriptive, not prescriptive. And that is, how would I describe for a record company what I think is the extant law concerning sampling? The problem that I had with the Higgins decision in Bridgeport is that the underlying logic represents the conflation, once again, of the standard for substantial similarity in the underlying composition with sampling. What I believe needs to be done is a loosening up and a moving on the continuum of greater freedom for use of sampling, but it can't necessarily be based on such conflation, that there need to be other criteria. For example, in Newton v. Diamond, Siva and I both cited, and I was working on behalf of Diamond, we made the case that the underlying music, which was simply a da-da-dum, that was it, was essentially a building block, and that no one could obtain a monopoly thereupon. If such analogous building blocks could be established in sampling, then one might have a different kind of underlying logic that would allow for greater freedom so that you don't necessarily have to just sample a snare drum for 1 second and have to pay a sampling license on it. So again, descriptive, not prescriptive.
Now that's a very helpful clarification. But the building block, to use sort of Terry's analogy of this morning, is more like the idea rather than the expression. But in other areas of creativity, people can take actual expression. They could take an actual measure of music, just like they could take an actual photo, just like they could take three sentences from a poem and reuse it. And as I said, the rickety fair use doctrine probably would tolerate that sort of behavior. In the music area, in particular the Sixth Circuit, where it says, no, get a license, there is less tolerance for that kind of borrowing. And that was the only point I think I was trying to make. Question back
just there. One comment I want to make also on those two with something that I just wanted to mention. With that case with the three notes, and they were all fighting back and forth whether or not they should be paid. The person who actually played that is this guy named Michael Hampton, who actually plays in the group Parliament Funkadelic. And I remember coming up to him like just a few months ago and being like, do you know that they're all fighting over this like solo that you did once, like some three notes from the solo? He's like, no shit, really? You know? And I was like, yeah, no, you don't understand. There's actually like, I think we're going to have a presentation. There's this group called Downhill Battle. They've got all these people to come and like remix it, and they're having like this whole contest. He's like, I'm entering that contest, you know. And he was just like, what, you know. And the thing is that, you know, it kind of like blows my mind that I would have to say that the attorneys who just were fighting just even in that one day made more money than he ever did in his whole lifetime off of the music that he played, and he wasn't even notified that there's this big dispute happening about, you know. So I think a lot of these things, you know, that happen, they get very, very, very far removed from, is this promoting people to be creative? Is this promoting people to go out? He's going to play probably 200 dates this year, and he'll play that song every night, you know, and it's just completely like a million steps away from what he is doing, and it has actually no impact on his musical career. So something to think about.
Thank you. Question back there.
Yeah, I mean, just segueing off of this, I think I'd like to hear more from the panel on this sort of culture of paranoia, you know, that produces the kinds of systems that we're seeing in terms of the licensing, et cetera. And I'd like you to talk maybe a little bit about what would it mean to create a culture of abundance in terms of creativity and creative work, and what those systems might look like. I mean, you all have touched on that, but I'd like to hear more of it.
I think as it turns out, abundance is what creates the paranoia. I mean, it's the fruits of connectivity, the fruits of low barriers to entry to produce amazing stuff, creates anxiety among professionals. It creates a sense of eroded status, fear of eroded potential for remuneration. I mean, all of those things get reflected in how we talk about this stuff. So while we have this astounding level of high bandwidth connectivity that's fueling and inspiring all this astounding creativity, we also have a culture of surveillance goes right along with it. People were sampling, remixing, making fabulous parodies of stuff for centuries, right? This is how culture works. We've known it for centuries. Anybody who's ever understood culture knows that all we're really seeing up here is an amplification and extension of what human beings have been doing in circles, drum circles, you know, fireside circles, sewing circles for centuries. But now someone cares, right? Someone is, what's the line from Barton Fink, he's taken an interest, right? That's the problem, right? He's taken an interest. The man has taken an interest. And that's a problem, and it's what's really dialed up this level of interest. And not only that, you have a perverse incentive system where lawyers, forgive me, Jeffrey, get paid by the tenth of an hour every 6 minutes to care about something that somebody else is doing many miles away for no money. That is a wacky incentive system. It's an incentive system we haven't fully interrogated. We're really into the incentive systems that drive artists and producers and publishers and distributors, although we haven't really mastered all that math. But, you know, there's something wacky about that sort of system where people have to care about Metallica. Like, what's the problem here? And yet, I wish I had my briefcase. I'd pull it out right now. But you know, if you go to Starbucks and you get the little cardboard things, the things that protect your hand from being burnt, so they don't get sued like McDonald's did. I call them coffee bras. I don't know if they have a real name for them. But take a look at it one day, because it has some pretty basic text on there. It says, this product is made from recycled material, like 75% recycled material, which is nice. It shows great green ethics right there. And then it says, for single use only, you know, which means you have to go and use as many as you can, and you can't reuse it, which so anti-green. But anyway, so that's pretty much what the text says. Under the text, it says, copyright Starbucks 2001. Why did Starbucks pay a lawyer to protect that stuff? What is the closest thing to non-expressive I can imagine, right? So that's protected, right? Then you've got the Starbucks logo, and it has a little R, so that's clearly something that Starbucks wants to protect. Then it says U.S. patent number, and it has a seven-digit number, all right? Now, what's interesting is if you go to Orin's, an independent coffee store in New York City, and you get their little coffee bra, it actually has a different patent number because one is a more generic patent than the other. We looked this up. My class and I looked this up. It turns out the Starbucks patent is for corrugated cardboard hand protection, and the other one is just the generic cardboard hand protection, not the corrugated one, which, of course, the one that's not corrugated, you don't have that imperative that you can't reuse it. Right, so what are we looking at here? We're looking at this one stupid little piece of cardboard, which to the rest of us is obvious, and it has probably cost $100,000 in lawyer time to produce, distribute, and protect. And that's being conservative. I mean, that is a wacky system. That is an incredible tax on the American economy. That's an incredible tax on all of our time. Right? I actually spent a half hour of my class last time talking about this when I could have been talking about something useful. And I've wasted your time talking about it, so I'll stop.
I just want to, I could have an extremely long answer to your question, but I am not personally a paranoid. I keep being tempted. But I do believe in the auto conspiracy. I mean, I do believe that there are sort of cultural views and paradigms that fit into economic principles that, you know, fit into legal and political principles that have ways of enforcing themselves and staying alive. And we are obviously at a great divide between one sequence in human history and the next. And the parties of the past are aggressively trying to defend themselves against the parties of the future. And a lot of what control may still be had in this world is around the issue of intellectual property protection. I have said before, and I believe strongly, that it is a very short distance between digital rights management to political rights management, especially the way in which we're going about trying to create digital rights management currently. It is a very dangerous path, but it's actually quite predictable that both of those forces would be working together at this time because they feel themselves rightly to be embattled by a whole new set of economic and political principles that have yet to be codified.
Can I say something? I just want to add one thing. I mean, actually, I'm really struck by the coffee example because it seems like the clearer answer is actually in your example. We're a rich and litigious society. Right. It's not. Yes, you can see.
We'd be richer if we were less litigious.
I don't think that's. I think you'd need a lot of evidence to convince me of that. Actually,
can I try?
But hang on, just one second. Intellectual property isn't the only thing where we've seen a lot of lawsuits and a lot of elaboration of laws and a lot of regulation. It just happens to be one that is particularly salient to the people in this room. But there are plenty of things where the regulations are just as complex and business people are just as concerned because we are a legalistic society, because we're a diverse society, where, you know, there aren't a lot of shared cultural norms that keep us together. We use legal norms in a lot of cases to substitute. And you can argue about whether that's good or bad, but you can't change it from intellectual property, right? You could, if you move to Japan, you will face a completely different culture, and it will be a completely different intellectual property culture too. But I think a lot, unfortunately, a lot of the proposals here seem think that we can change this area without changing everything else.
But 20 years ago, we were a diverse and dynamic and rich people, and 20 years ago, we didn't worry about the cardboard around our coffee.
I would even take it a whole different place. I do think Future Music tries to look at these questions from a bigger position. We're not just looking at intellectual property. We're trying to look at the entire landscape in which artists create. And I embrace the abundance that comes with the new technology, the ability to make more music, more musicians, to be able to have access to more of an audience, all of those ideas. That said, I was lucky enough to be in the room with a funder who works at an arts foundation that gives about $16 million away every year to dance and theater and all this stuff. And they were asking experts in the field, mostly artists themselves, how can we do a better job? Tell me what's failing you at this moment. And people talked about needing bigger budgets for certain things or more support for theaters, different kinds of stuff, you know, more interaction between artists in different fields, whatever. But ultimately, at the end of a full day of conversation, the thing that we came up with that this foundation could do to help artists would be to work for universal health care. Because every single musician and dancer and artist in the space spends $200 to $500 a month that they can't afford or doesn't spend it and falls and then never dances again. And so I think we've got this incredibly ironic, this sort of these poles that artists are fighting between with this language of abundance, while at the same time, you know, it's impossible for artists who live in New York City to find space. It is impossible for artists, you know, as gas goes up, can you tour? And one thing that Future of Music noticed is that, you know, there's this incredible drop-off with the artists that we talk with at around the age 25 when they decide they need to get a real job so they can have health insurance because they're going to get married or because they want to buy a house or these other things that were promised in this abundant country. So I would just say that if we took care of ourselves, if we really were in an abundant place where people felt like they actually could meet a mortgage payment, could have health insurance, could have access to an audience on their local radio station, musicians would be far less controlling about their art. But the fact of the matter is, we see here 33 million people see themselves as artists, 10 million make some amount of money from their art, and then only 1% of people who sign major label deals are in the black as opposed to the red. So there's not a lot of money. Or safety.
So I think not just because of the schedule, because this has reached, it seems, a natural wrapping up point. We should stop. Thank our panelists very much. And we have one more session. I would Do you want to announce this?